This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Coming up in this program, leading scientist Dr. David Karoly says record heat and fires in Australia are a warning to the world. But we are not alone in the big change. Insects may adapt or die faster than humans, as told by the Bug Guy, University of Maryland's Dr. Michael Raup. Then Stephen Davis explains why climate solutions advanced just 9 years ago are no longer possible. A new report says existing technology is not enough to stem the climate tide. So now what? Welcome to another full load from Radio EcoShock. You've heard about extreme heat and fires in Australia at the start of 2013. Is it climate change? We go now to one of that country's leading climate experts, Dr. David J. Karoly. He's been a lead IPCC author and advises the Australian government through the Climate Change Authority. After a stint teaching meteorology at the University of Oklahoma, Karoly is now at the School of Earth Sciences, University of Melbourne. Dr. Karoly, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Welcome to you too, and I'm happy to be here.
It's ironic. Just as I wrote you about the relative quiet in Australia, your country went into a record-smashing heat wave. How does this Australian summer stack up?
Well, we're still right in the middle of the summer, so we can't really look back at how hot it is over the whole summer relative to previous years. But certainly we've already set a number of countrywide records for extreme high temperatures. Record high temperatures have been set, record all-time temperatures have been set in Sydney and Canberra last week. Record high temperatures for the average maximum temperature averaged across the whole of the country. And records for the extent and duration of the heat wave that's really now lasted for more than 2 weeks. But, you know, one of the interesting things when we look at, say, high temperatures, both in Australia and in many other countries, Australia is roughly the size of the United States or roughly the same area as Canada. And often you'll find that it's hot in one part of the country, but cooler in the opposite part of the country. So it might be, you know, hot on the west coast and cool on the east coast, or vice versa. The interesting thing about this heat wave is that it's extended across a large part of the country. And we've had the new area average record maximum temperature. And what we've had is, in fact, 6 days in a row where the record area average maximum temperature was above 39 degrees Celsius. So if we convert that into Fahrenheit, that's about 102 Fahrenheit averaged across the whole of the area of Australia, and Australia exceeded that for 6 days in a row. So the heatwave was widespread and long-lasting.
Well, I want to dig deeper into that, but first I just want to ask you a quick question. You taught meteorology at the University of Oklahoma. That's a state known for oil and maybe climate denial, at least in its leadership. Did you experience resistance there?
You're absolutely right. I was a professor at the University of Oklahoma in the Department of Meteorology for 5 years, from 2003 to 2007. And I was recruited to, if you like, strengthen the climate science expertise in that department. I found that there was, a wide range of opinions on climate science and climate change. Obviously, Oklahoma is the middle of the United States, a relatively conservative state. Many of the people were very much aware of changes in climate. Oklahoma has experienced heat waves and drought in many of the years recently. And for the last two summers in the United States has experienced record high temperatures and very low rainfall. So the people in Oklahoma were already experiencing, have been experiencing high temperatures and impacts of climate change as well as climate variability. So they were very much aware of what was going on. Their understanding of the causes or their interpretation of the causes varied depending on who you talk to. The conservative senator from Oklahoma, Senator Inhofe, has said repeatedly that global warming is the greatest scientific hoax ever perpetrated on the American public. So he's obviously a climate change denier. But equally, the president of the university and many other people in Oklahoma were keen to support both greater research and communication on the impacts of climate change, on the link between human activity and increasing greenhouse gases on climate change around the world, and particularly preparation for the increasing temperatures and the impacts of climate change in North America.
Well, I'm glad you clarified that, because it always seems strange when a place that's hit so hard still has some people resisting it at the top. Well, getting back to Australia, what is the Climate Commission? And please tell us about the recent report, Off the Charts, Extreme Australian Summer Heat.
The Climate Commission is an independent body established by the Australian government now 3 years ago to enhance or improve the communication of climate science and climate change information, including the impacts of climate change, to the Australian public. So it undertakes to prepare reports and have community information sessions in cities and regional centres all around Australia on climate variability, on climate change, and on the impacts of climate change, both currently and projected into the future. One of the things that the Climate Commission decided to do, given the heat wave, was rapidly prepare a short report looking at both the current heat wave in Australia and the associated bushfires or wildfires that are occurring in many parts of Australia at the current time. Look at explaining those in terms of the typical summertime high temperatures and wildfire occurrence in Australia, and why, when we look at long-term data records for more than 100 years, we can see clear increasing trends in high temperatures and increasing trends in the weather conditions associated with these extreme wildfires, and that those are likely due to human-caused climate change. So the Climate Commission report was released just over a week ago, and it has received a lot of attention both in the media and from community groups because it tries to provide the best scientific information about what is going on, and was supported with data from the National Weather Service in Australia called the Bureau of Meteorology and other information from long-term weather and climate records.
Well, I'm going to put a link to that report in my blog at ecoshock.info so people can give it a good look. You know, this reminds me, a couple of years ago, Australia suffered through a massive drought, especially in the Murray-Darling region, where farmers were stressed out. Some gave up entirely. It was very much like the big 2012 drought in America. Have Australian farmers recovered from that blow?
In many areas, yes, farmers have recovered. You're absolutely right. The period from 1997 to 2010 in Australia was a record low rainfall for much of eastern and southern Australia, and a very long-term low rainfall, which has been linked to human-caused climate change as well, although the exact extent of the climate change influence versus natural variability is still uncertain. But it was a record long-term drought. Farmers, as you said, had to adapt to that. And as you said, a number of farmers changed their operations or gave up completely. The really interesting thing is that Australia, for a long time, has been described as a land of droughts and flooding rains because of the very strong influence of natural climate variability associated with the El Niño and La Niña events that influence the west coast of North America, but they very much have an influence in eastern Australia. In 2010 through 2012, we had two La Niña events, one after the other. La Niña events is when there's cold ocean temperatures in the equatorial Pacific Ocean. They contribute to dry conditions in the central southern part of the United States. So the dry conditions or drought in 2010 to 2012 in Oklahoma and Texas is likely associated with these La Niña sea surface temperatures in the Pacific. But they lead to very wet conditions in Australia. And for the last 2 years, from 2010 to 2012, well, until the middle of 2012, we had very wet, both summer and winter conditions in much of Australia. and that's allowed the farmers to recover. And we've had very good conditions, in fact, very lush pastures, very good crop growth and recovery of many of the reservoirs to nearly full catchments in many areas of Australia associated with 2 years of rainfall. However, if we look at the longer-term records, there is, in fact, still, if you like, long-term rainfall deficit, even though we've had two very good years, associated with the 13 years of low rainfall from 1997 to 2010. And we switched in the middle of 2012, or the last third of 2012, to low rainfall again in much of southern and eastern Australia. There was a precursor to these record heat waves and wildfire conditions in much of southern and eastern Australia.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith, with our guest, Dr. David Karoly, one of Australia's leading climate experts. David, I asked you about the previous lull in the Australian heat and after those fires of 2009, partly because I'm afraid climate change will go into a quiet period, perhaps due to natural cycles, and then pop out worse a few years later. I note the UK Met Office has reduced its prediction slightly for the next few years. Do scientists worry that the public will just go to sleep if we don't see these great heat waves and not do anything?
You're absolutely right that climate change is superimposed on the natural variability of the climate system. And one of the difficult things in communication about climate change is to try to present clearly that even with large variations in rainfall or temperatures, that climate change doesn't mean record high temperatures every year, but that if we look at the longer term records, in effect, when we look at the climate, the 5 or 10 year averages, it's only on those sorts of timescales that we can see clearer trends in climate. And so, yes, climate scientists are concerned about the most effective communication and that we need to ensure that the public and particularly policymakers are aware that one wet year or one cool year doesn't mean that climate change has disappeared or gone away. That in fact we need to look at large areas across the globe and longer term records to see the influence of human activity and increasing greenhouse gases on the climate system. And when we do that, we can see very clear signals. When we look at records of, say, Arctic ice extent in summer, we see long-term decreasing trends. When we look at heat content in the upper layers of the ocean, we see long-term warming trends. And when we look at global average temperatures, not just in an individual year, but 5 or 10 year averages, we see long-term warming trends. And the message that the climate is no longer warming is in fact completely wrong. When we look at the current decade, it is warmer than the previous decade, which was warmer than the previous decade when we look at surface temperatures. When we look at year-to-year variations, yes, there is large natural variability. But when we look at the climate, we see long-term warming trends.
Well, to an outside observer, David, Australia seems a bit schizophrenic. We hear progressive talk from top politicians, and at least they admit there is climate change. And at the same time, the federal and state governments, some of them are going full speed ahead to increase the country's coal exports, maybe doubling sales to China or India. And now Australians are being hit over the head with the results. Is there any chance the coal industry can be reined in before we do reach catastrophic changes?
First of all, the Australian government has introduced a price on carbon dioxide emissions associated with industrial activity in Australia. It's introduced a carbon pricing mechanism, as it's described, as a lead-in to a full Australian greenhouse gas emissions trading scheme linked to the European Union's emissions trading scheme for carbon dioxide emissions. The price on carbon dioxide is $26 a tonne of emissions currently, and that increases every year associated with inflation and then goes to a full emissions trading scheme in 2015. So Australia has set a price on carbon, which is a step in the right direction. The price is too low at present to lead to major emission reductions. but Australia has set a target for 5% emission reductions below 2000 levels by 2020. And that is an important step. In fact, the really interesting thing is that the price on carbon and increases in electricity prices are leading to reductions in electricity consumption from burning fossil fuels, and in fact reductions in emissions associated with electricity generation in Australia over the last 2 years. So both of those things are really good moves. On the other hand, Australian governments at the federal and state level are seeking to export coal and natural gas as quickly as possible and expand the exports of those. And I've likened that to being a drug dealer to try to reduce your own adverse impacts by not consuming yourself or reducing your own consumptions, but to sell this harmful product to other users overseas so that you make money from selling this harmful product. Unfortunately, it's even worse than being a drug dealer, because with drugs and you sell them to someone else, you don't actually get the adverse impacts. For Australia, selling coal overseas, Australia still receives the adverse impacts from a warming climate due to emissions of Australian coal when it's burnt in Asian countries or other countries around the world. It's a schizophrenic attitude. I have lobbied against that in Australia. I have written to the electricity generators in Australia and have recently signed a public letter advocating that there should be no increase in coal exports in Australia.
You know, those frightening scenes of Australia fires and Tasmania burning, is that something that is just happening in Australia? I mean, there's always been fires there, even from the times of the Aboriginal peoples. Or is that something that we should be expecting in the Americas or Eurasia as well?
It is certainly the case that in specific susceptible parts of the world, there have been an increase in wildfire occurrence. It's associated with the regions of the world that we would typically describe as having a Mediterranean climate, which often means relatively low rainfall in summer and relatively high temperatures. So obviously areas around the Mediterranean, but there are also areas in the United States and similar parts of the world where there's been marked increase in fire frequency and area burnt. It's also true that in Canada, there have been increases in forest fires, not every year, but in drier years, particularly in summer, increases in the area burnt by fires that have been clearly linked to human-caused climate change, leading to hotter temperatures in summer and therefore increased risk of wildfire in dry years. So not every year, but an increased frequency and area burnt of wildfires in Canada.
And when it comes to the climate, what are you telling Australians they should expect in the next 50 years if we just keep going the way we're going?
Unfortunately, Australia is one of the developed countries, if not the developed country, that experiences the worst of the adverse impacts of climate change. So in 50 years' time, we're looking at marked increases in Australian temperatures, likely of the order of 2 to 3 degrees. Dramatic increases in the frequency of extreme high temperatures and the frequency of extreme wildfire conditions. In parts of Australia, increases in rainfall, particularly in northern Australia and some parts with summertime rainfall. Reductions in rainfall, particularly in wintertime, in much of southern Australia. And given that the wintertime rainfall is what replenishes many of the reservoirs, decreases in water resources, particularly for irrigation in many parts of southern and eastern Australia. Decreases in snow cover in the alpine areas in Australia, affecting many ecosystems. Increasing in ocean temperatures, leading to adverse impacts on marine ecosystems, as well as increases in acidity in the oceans, again leading to adverse impacts on ocean ecosystems, major increases in frequency of bleaching in coral reefs, particularly in northeastern Australia, the Great Barrier Reef, but also in coral reefs in Western Australia, and likely major adverse impacts and major decline in coral reef systems, major declines in the alpine ecosystems in northern Australia, and in 50 years, while most people are surprised that there is already a skiing industry in Australia, that skiing industry will have disappeared in Australia. And many of the alpine ecosystems will be heading towards extinction because of the absence of long-term snow cover in the wintertime. So a lot of really adverse impacts in Australia. There are one or two beneficial impacts. There will be warmer temperatures in the far south of Australia, in the state of Tasmania, which will likely lead to increases in the growing season and increases in agricultural productivity in many parts of Tasmania. But that's about the only area that appears to get some beneficial impacts from climate change in 50 years' time, unless you consider that having the seaside property moving inland, if you're already maybe a kilometre from the coast, that's a beneficial impact. But I think many of the people in the coastal fringe would argue that that's probably not a beneficial impact to having sea level rise and storm surges affecting further inland.
Well, this is going to change the whole continent from something since the settlers arrived into something completely different. Is there anything else you'd like to leave with our listeners for both Australia and the world?
I think maybe that what I've described for Australia is really like a canary in the coal mine. As I said, Australia is the developed country that is suffering most from the adverse impacts of climate change. But many of the same sorts of impacts will be happening or are already happening in many different countries around the world. And so the sorts of impacts that I've described are affecting the United States, are affecting many other mid-latitude countries around the world and many of the tropical countries as well. So Australia should be seen as just an early example of many of the adverse impacts of climate change and therefore an indicator that action on climate change is critical to slow down warming of the climate system and to try to meet the globally agreed target of limiting warming to only 2 degrees above pre-industrial levels.
Well, thank you. I'm Alex Smith. You've just heard from Dr. David Karoly, the Australian climate expert. You can find more links to the recent report Off the Charts and more in my show blog at ecoshock.info. David, thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
You're welcome, Alex.
Radio EcoShock.
Still coming up, Stephen Davis from the University of California on the rapid death of wedge theory. But first, we're not alone here. The insects are also responding to climate change. Here to explain is the bug guy, University of Maryland entomologist Dr. Michael J. Rope. Michael, thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
It's my pleasure to be here today, Alex.
Well, what are some of the big bug stories as the world warms?
Well, really, I think it boils down to three major things. Number one, insects and mites are normally constrained in temperate climates like North America by colder temperatures. So as the world warms, what we might expect to see, what we are actually seeing already here in North America, is expansion of the range of insects into higher latitudes and altitudes. In other words, they're moving further north, and they're also moving higher in mountains than they ever have before. That's point number one. Point number two is that as the season advances, and there was a piece, just last week in one of the major news sources that talked about the fact that plants may be blooming anywhere from a month to perhaps 6 weeks earlier than they had just a century and a half ago. So this also means that insects will begin to be active much earlier in the season and as the warm temperatures linger much later into the season. That's point number two. And point number three, is that many of our insects are what we call multivoltine. What this means is they can complete several generations every year. Certain insects, things like the gypsy moth, for example, have but one generation a year. We call those univoltine. But for many smaller insects and some of our important pests, things like mosquitoes and spider mites and leaf beetles, they may complete several generations a year. And as the world warms, they're simply going to have more generations a year. And that means a lot more bugs hanging around. So I think things are changing in several important ways.
And how does heat affect the bugs? If it's really a lot hotter, what happens for them?
Well, fundamentally, insects have what we call a developmental threshold. In other words, at certain low temperatures, the bugs in Vancouver right now are doing nothing but sitting there being cold, because the temperatures are below their developmental threshold. But as the temperatures increase, and oftentimes somewhere about perhaps around 10 degrees or 15 degrees Celsius, they'll actually begin to develop. In other words, their physiological processes will kick in, and there's a very simple relationship between temperature and development in insect, and it's simple. The hotter it is, the faster they develop. This will increase to a certain point, however, somewhere around perhaps 30 or 35 degrees will reach an upper threshold for those insects, and continued exposure to those temperatures will, of course, be lethal. But that window in between, it simply means that the warmer it is, the faster the bug develops. This simply means they can complete more generations in less time.
And 30 and 35, you're talking about centigrade, so that'd be over 100 Fahrenheit for the American listener. You know, other places, poor old England, for example, is being hit with extreme rainfall events. The wet weather hardly stops, except when it drops loads of snow instead. How does that change in the hydrology cycle, the water world? How does that affect the insects?
Well, in terms of their development, of course, drought is critically important. Insects, like all other organisms, have to have water. It's a critical element. So the water-dwelling insects, the ones that depend on water, things like our mayflies and damselflies, of course, when we go through periods of drought, this is critical to those particular organisms. But the thing, I guess, that's really important here is many of our serious disease vectors, and now I'm talking about things like mosquitoes, also depend on water. So water cycles will affect the ability of insects to breed, of course, particularly those species that are aquatic. But by and large, our terrestrial insects are getting enough water through the plants they feed on, through dew and moisture that they imbibe directly, that they're probably going to be okay. Drought would have to be severe. There's a more indirect role here, Alex. The other piece of this puzzle, this weather cycle, the moisture cycle, is that plants depend very heavily, of course, on water, because it's one of the resource materials in that process of photosynthesis, CO2 plus H2O. So without water, plants simply can't do their job of photosynthesis. What this means is that when we have water shortages, droughted, for example, that this will stress plants, and stress can predispose plants to attack by many different kinds of insects. Some of our most egregious borers, things like that Asian longhorn beetle and the mountain pine beetle and the emerald ash borer, will all be favored by periods of drought. So there is a relationship with water, but back to our point here, this business about climate change and global warming really, really are going to shift the way bugs and plants do their business for the foreseeable future, I think.
We'll be right back in just a minute with more Radio EcoShock.